I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. When Philadelphia voters elected Larry Krasner DA last year, they knew they were getting an unconventional top prosecutor. For one, he had never prosecuted a case, having spent his career as a defense and civil rights attorney. He'd campaigned on the promise of ending mass incarceration, reforming the cash bail system, investigating police misconduct. Philadelphia has had the highest incarceration rate in the country, with more people on parole than any other state. Shortly after being sworn in, he cleaned house, firing some 30 ADAs and later announced lesser sentences for nonviolent offenses, for pot possession and shoplifting. But not everyone is happy with Krasner's reform agenda. The Philadelphia Police Officers Union is suing Krasner, the mayor, and the police commissioner over the release of a do-not-call list of cops with reputations for unreliable court testimony. Krasner has also been criticized by a number of crime victims' families for his office's approach to prosecuting homicides and not keeping them informed. It's been several months, and Larry Krasner joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back with us.
Great to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I want to start with this 3.5 to 10 year sentence for Javon Patterson. He shot a man named Michael Pang using an AK-47. The U.S. attorney here in Philadelphia, William McSwain, called it a sweetheart deal for a violent defendant. Help us understand what your office was thinking.
So this is a case, and we've been very clear about this, in which a very good prosecutor made a mistake and did not follow the office's policy to go to a supervisor to clear the deal. And also, even though there was extensive contact with the victim, even in the hospital, there was extensive contact. There was not contact as there should have been as we got down to the point of the deal itself. Once this came to the attention of, you know, people who were essentially at the top of the office, we immediately addressed it and we filed a motion to try to modify that deal. I mean, it is what it is. We handle 40,000 cases. A mistake was made by a good prosecutor who has been spoken to, and we're making efforts to remedy it. It will either be remedied in court or it's going to be remedied at the parole end, meaning that when it comes time for the defendant to be considered for parole, my office will say what it has to say about whether we think enough time has been served. But you know,
and that would be at the 3.5 year?
Yeah, at 3.5 years, there will be consideration. As you may know, at least half of the time, parole is rejected. And when the DA's office weighs in heavily saying don't parole, that is a factor that's considered by the parole board and may impact departure. I mean, the fact is that Mr. Pang, even if this deal remains, could do 10 years in jail on this. He will simply be considered for
meaning
parole.
Mr. Patterson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Patterson. That's right. He will simply be considered for parole before that date.
The victim of this crime said he was not consulted and was not told about this decision made by your office. That's illegal, as I understand it.
The law requires us to make efforts to consult. And as I said before, this is a victim who was visited in the hospital. When the case first occurred, there was preparation and there was conversation, there was communication at the time the case went towards a preliminary hearing. But there was a failure on the part of the office to get a hold of the victim when it got to the point where this prosecutor, who, as I said, was a good prosecutor, made a mistake, was disposing of the case.
What would have been, what do you think is a more appropriate than sentence for this kind of crime?
You know, we have a pending matter in which a judge has to make a decision about whether to alter the situation. I think it would be inappropriate before we get to that juncture for my office to stand up. But I can tell you I consider the sentence to be insufficient. Mm-hmm. You know, we had – this was obviously big in the press, and we had a meeting once it came to our attention where we said, what would we do if the press was not covering this?
Right.
And the answer was we would admit that a mistake was made. We would file a motion to change it regardless of the outcome in the press, and that's what we've done.
Let me go back to McSwain, who told the Inquirer of the Philadelphia Daily News that your office had abdicated its responsibility as prosecutor, I guess you, unconcerned about providing justice to victims, preoccupied with advocating for defendants. What do you say in response?
Well, Mr. McSwain is a story. This is a Trump appointee. This is someone who, you know, has repeatedly established that he has a completely different philosophy, that he, like Jeff Sessions, before Jeff Sessions departed, wants to go back to the war on drugs. and that his approach to criminal justice is not just mass incarceration, but even more mass incarceration. He and I simply don't agree. That's the reality. And these are touchy times for people like him. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold.
That's all right.
They're touchy times for people like him because they all just got hit with a blue wave. This is not the first time that he and I have, on the one hand, had deep philosophical disagreements about criminal justice, and on the other hand, worked together. At the same time, he's saying things like this. People in his office who I've known for 20 years are on the phone with me asking me to do certain things to assist them, and we're doing it. We're doing it every day. So, you know, I think it's to be expected in a superheated political environment. I think it's unfortunate since we work closely with people in his office, but it is what it is.
Do you work at all with him? And I have to say, the spokesman for your office called him a grandstander, his remarks in the best tradition of Donald Trump. Do you have a – is this personal between you and McSwain?
I mean, I don't think I've gone to the press to call him out. I think the only thing that has happened here is we're responding to what he has said. It's not personal. I think that he is you know, doing the political bidding of the Trump administration, just as Jeff Sessions called me out and called this DA's office out a few months ago. We do profoundly disagree philosophically. Ultimately, you know, Mr. McSwain is appointed by a president whose stature as president is very much in question. And
political?
It's political. I mean, I have no personal distaste or dislike for Mr. McSwain. I think the comments are inappropriate, but honestly, I don't think it's all that important.
Let me ask you, and obviously you got this job to change the way criminal justice is done in the city. And as I mentioned in my introduction, a number of families of homicide victims or people who have been killed in this city feel as if your office is not representing them. And I want to read something that Linda Schellinger said. This was a month or so ago, but she wrote in the Philadelphia Inquirer, "My son Sean Schellinger was murdered July 12th. What I have learned since that is what too many victims' families in the city have already experienced. Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner is not, in my opinion, working for justice in violent crime cases. My son was murdered, and Krasner, who is my son's legal representative, agreed to a reduced charge in this case before a judge or jury had the opportunity to consider the original charge made by his office." And I know part of what you want to do is to change the way perhaps cases are charged or, in your mind, overcharged. Help us understand.
Sure. Well, first of all, Mrs. Schellinger is going through a tremendous amount of grief, as you can anyone could understand who has had a child, or maybe even if you have not had a child. Sure. I have met with her personally and at length twice in my office. I've been in court with her for quite a long period of time at the preliminary hearing, and I have heard and considered everything she has to say. But the truth about the Michael White case is it's not a first-degree murder case. The truth about the Michael White case, and we put a tremendous amount of time into investigating it, looking at the law.
And would she say her son was stabbed?
Her son had a confrontation with a person he did not know in an affluent area of Philadelphia. It was a very racially charged situation because the younger defendant is an African-American food delivery worker, and the her son, Mr. Schellinger, the victim, was stabbed in a confrontation one time in the back, and a confrontation that occurred very quickly, right?
So it
had,
and he died.
And it's captured the imagination of the city. On the one hand, we had people who felt like the defendant should not have been charged at all, that it's obviously self-defense and that anyone would see that, and therefore there should be no charges. On the other hand, we had people who said, well, this is obviously first degree. And, never mind the fact that there are five different levels of homicide. Mm-hmm. There are only two speeds in this car. One is no charges at all. The other one is first degree. That is legally incorrect. It is factually incorrect. The facts and the law around this push us in the direction of neither refusing to prosecute nor prosecuting a charge for which there is no basis, and that is a first degree.
Let me go back to one more thing that she said in this piece, which is that she has been a supporter of much of what you want to do in this city in terms of sentences being too long, people incarcerated inappropriately. But she goes on to say violent crimes, especially murder, should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And I know from having interviewed you before, but also as you ran for DA, is that you have been a critic of prosecutors who go for the highest charge and you want to figure out how to rebalance that. Help us understand that.
Well, you know, the oath of a prosecutor is to seek justice. It's not to seek an unjust conviction. And what has happened for decades in Philadelphia is that prosecutors have been political, and they have always pursued the highest charge, even when they knew there was not a basis. They have basically been lying to victims and misleading victims and their families by simply saying, well, sure, we'll go for the death penalty. Sure, we'll go for first degree, when there was not a basis for those charges. And then, of course, when what happened is usually what happens, meaning a jury rejects the charge or the judge rejects the charge, they would not own it. They would not accept their own responsibility. They would simply lie again to these victims and say, well, that judge is, you know, a terrible defense lawyer, or that jury is just stupid, or something to that effect. We cannot be part of that. If we're going to seek justice, it has to be individual justice. It's got to be based on the facts and the law in that particular case.
Is it about intent? I mean, is that part of also the job of your office, which is to figure out intent when dealing with a serious crime?
I mean, intent is really the crux of all criminal law. I think we all understand that if you have a car accident and someone dies in that car accident, and you've made an honest mistake, that is not a criminal matter. Even if you kill five people, it's not a criminal matter. On the other hand, if in a rage you aim your car at some people and you deliberately drive at them, that is a terrible crime. Mm-hmm. So intent is the crux. And, you know, over hundreds of years, we have evolved a system of homicide that, at least in Pennsylvania, consists of five different levels. The real difference between these levels is, in almost every instance, is the level of intent.
I'm curious, though, can you understand, though, how a victim's family wants the long arm of the law to come down as a hammer for someone that murders a member of their family?
Oh, I absolutely understand that. And I know that if someone killed a family member of mine, my initial reaction would probably not even be to resort to the law. I would probably feel an impulse to go get a gun and find it myself, right? I understand that that is an aspect of human nature, an aspect of family. But this is also the reason why the law says that the victim cannot be, or the family of the victim cannot be the judge in a case, that they would be disqualified because they cannot be dispassionate and look at the facts impartially, look at the law. It's why we say that a relative of the victim cannot be on a jury, cannot even be one of 12 people or 14 people, depending, an alternate. They can't have any role in a jury because it's an obvious bias. It obviously is going to have an emotional impact on your decision making.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Larry Krasner is our guest. He's Philadelphia's district attorney. He was sworn in just about a year ago, and part of a phenomenon in the country of progressive prosecutors. And you can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We have many more things to talk about that obviously have of deep interest to those of us who live and work here in Philadelphia. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner. Here's a tweet from Thomas. What is the new DA's view regarding the uptick of murders in Philadelphia during this year? According to what we got this morning, police data show that there have been 333 homicides in the city as of Sunday, so as of just 2 days ago. What do you make of that?
Well, obviously it's a matter of extreme concern to all of us. This is the fifth consecutive year when there has been an increase in homicides in Philadelphia. And it arrives in a kind of a curious way, because on the one hand, we have this very disturbing uptick in homicides, and we do have an uptick in shootings. But if you look at violent crime overall, according to Philadelphia police statistics, and this number will include homicides and shootings, it's actually down 6%, right? So, we took a closer look, and we've actually looked more specifically at the motives that were involved in the homicides that are being investigated. And we see one thing that stands out very strongly, and that is that the number of cases in 2017 where the primary motive had to do with drugs was 62.
Wow.
And the number of cases in 2018 where police have classified the primary motive as being drugs is 120. if we look at all these other categories, things like, you know, argument or retaliation or highway robbery, things like that, we find fairly consistent numbers last year to this. But the one real outlier, the one that seems to have doubled and may even more than double, is drugs.
Now, is drugs.
Yeah.
So fights over drugs.
Yes. I mean, obviously, we're all aware that Philadelphia is one of the worst counties in the United States for opioid overdoses and for opioid activity. It is another very serious concern that we have, and it seems to be corresponding to an uptick in homicides, which, I mean, it kind of makes sense. When there's a lot of money to be had over drugs and people are fighting over turf and they obviously can't go to court because it is an illegal market, this is what one tends to see. So it's going to be a crucial part of the efforts that the city makes and we make to try to see how we can bring these numbers down.
In what way? In what way can your office bring these numbers down?
Well, there are very, very serious ongoing discussions right now within my office in terms of the policy unit and our criminologist about looking at good versions, and I repeat, good versions of focused deterrence, mm-hmm. of a violence intervention, and all of these other things that I think are regarded as being short-term ways to address the problems. We've already done a few things. I mean, one of the most important things we've done, I believe, is that we have come up with this program in which we're going to have advocates for the families of homicide victims from the moment of the killing who will be better placed to allow the homicide detectives to go out and clear cases, meaning find the perpetrator of the case. To the extent you're able to do that quickly, you often cut off the second shooting or the third shooting. So that's a thing we've done. But we are also working hand in glove, frankly, with the police department on things like this terrible shooting and killing of four people in the basement of a house
yes.
in West Philadelphia. And we have, together with the police department, who've done an excellent job, not only been able to find suspects, but we have now made additional investigative steps. We'll be talking about that in public within a day or two that have to do with resolving that crime. So we are going to do everything that we can, both in the sphere of violence interruption and also within traditional law enforcement. But let's get real. The big issues here, Marty, people may not want to hear it, but it's true. The big issues here have to do with the abandonment of the things that prevent crime over a period of decades. When you wreck public schools, when you don't have treatment for mental illness, when you have rampant poverty that is not addressed, this is what you get. And it is not true that the police department or a DA can press a button and stop this when this is in motion for decades. We have to look for the long-term solutions in addition to looking for shorter-term solutions.
And I should just underscore what you said. Philadelphia is the poorest large city in the country with a poverty rate of about 25%. It has not budged in years in spite of all the efforts of mayors and district attorneys and police and other educators, other people in the city. It seems to be stuck at that number.
It does, although I think there's reason for hope. The, you know, and I know this well because, frankly, there are some young people in my family. Philadelphia has become a magnet for millennials, and millennials are curious people because, among other things, they like to live in cities, and a lot of them want their kids to go to public schools in cities. That's a good thing. I mean, we are attracting population in terms of immigrant communities in ways that can be very constructive. I think there is, you know, we just got announced as being the city of the year by GQ magazine. And so I think that there are reasons to believe that Brooklyn's full, San Francisco's full, and the wonderful city that Philadelphia is going to attract people and attract a tax base. And then we may be able to do a lot.
Tell us about one of your things that you campaigned on was ending cash bail, the cash bail system. What's the status on that?
So that has been a remarkable adventure, and I think it's indicative of one of the real successes we've had so far. The level of incarceration in the county was 6,500 when we came into office. As of a couple of days ago, it is 4,700. Understand that this is down from a high, I'd say 5 or 6 years ago, of 10,000, okay? So needless to say, the rhetoric around this coming from the opponents of what we did with bail was that you're going to have the city ablaze, that you're going to have rampant crime, this terrible crime spike. Well, no, we didn't. I mean, yes, of course, we have situations involving shootings and killings, and that is terrible. But crime is not up in the city of Philadelphia. There is
overall crime.
Overall crime is not up, and violent crime overall is not up. And as we look at the people who were let out of jail, who might otherwise have been there for nonviolent offenses, which is what we targeted, for offenses that do not include sex offenses, as we look at that crowd, we see they're going to court. They're not involved in recidivism. None of that connects in any way to the shootings and killings that are going on. So it's a big deal to have so much more freedom, to be able to close a jail, which has happened. It's a big deal at $135 a cell. And, you know, again, these numbers are a little theoretical, but at $135 a cell, you take 1,800 people out of those jail cells and you start multiplying it out. You get into tens of millions of dollars. I think if you checked right now, you would probably find even the city agrees that in terms of actual dollars, not theoretical dollars, we're well over $10 million in savings on what's going on in county jail. That money needs to go into the long-term things that are going to stop shootings and stop killings.
Like education?
Like education, like treatment for mental illness, like treatment for the disease that is drug addiction, like job training, like economic development. That's where it needs to go. And as we move forward into the next year, we are going to ask the city to link arms with us in making sure that the money doesn't just go for tax breaks for large out-of-town companies, that the money is going to go directly into the things that are going to prevent crime in the long term.
I'm looking at a Philadelphia Inquirer article that quotes the ACLU. They did an analysis of the 2018 dockets, finding 42.5% of defendants still get cash bail. So it's not as if you have entirely stopped the cash bail system, especially as it applies to poor Philadelphians. But obviously made some reductions, but almost half of them still cash bail.
Right. I think that that's – I mean, I don't know their statistics, but it's probably right. I do not want people who are shooting people to be getting out of jail without paying bail. I do not want people who are charged with sex offenses to be getting out of jail without having to pay bail. I don't want people who are arrested with a firearm and they have a prior felony, or high-level white-collar criminals, to be getting out without having to pay bail. And so we came in with a very carefully crafted policy that so far seems to really have towed the line between public safety and increasing freedom and increasing resources for the things that prevent crime. We feel pretty good about it. We've made great strides in the last few weeks in terms of dealing with detainers, mm-hmm. parole detainers, probation detainers, things of that sort, which actually got us down from about a 5,000 number closer to this 4,700 number. And by the way, this is a team effort. You know, the city and the MacArthur Foundation have been working on this for a long time. The difference, though, between the stagnation that was experienced before we came into office and what's happened this year has been that they have a willing partner.
You have described the cash bail system as essentially imprisonment for poverty.
It often is. I mean, especially when you talk about the categories of offenses where we didn't even used to give people jail time in the 1970s. It is, because middle class people and working people can always pay the relatively small amounts of bail in question. But poor people sit, and they sit at great expense to the public, and it just makes things worse.
I was reading somewhere that half people in jail will have, I guess, once they get into court, not found guilty. Does that make sense to you?
You know, it does make sense to me. We've looked at statistics. It's a higher number than I guess I would have anticipated anecdotally based upon my personal experience, mm-hmm. but the statistics do support that.
That is Larry Krasner, and he is Philadelphia District Attorney, part of an interesting trend in this country of defense attorneys becoming head prosecutors in cities like Philadelphia. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, a tweet from Matt, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, blaming Trump and Sessions to not answer a question about ignoring victims. Anything you want to say back to Matt? This was when we were talking earlier about victims feeling as if they were not being heard by your office.
I mean, I'm not quite sure what his question is, but I'll try to answer what it might be.
Okay.
I think when we obtain $1.5 million to do something that's never been done before by the Philly DA's office, to have a network of over 12 people who are themselves victims of terrible crimes, who are going to frankly hold the hands of families of victims so that they can be helped through every step of the process, and we do it without going into the taxpayers' pocket, I think we've done something for victims. I think when you have a chief district attorney who, unlike all of his predecessors, meets personally with victims over and over.
This would be you.
Yeah, and tells them the truth about what's going on rather than using them for political purposes. I think that means you care about victims. So I respectfully disagree. I was a victim myself. I was, as you may know.
Yes, you were.
I was robbed. I was cut in the face. And none of that compares to the pain that people I see all the time when I meet with them are going through. But I'm well aware of what it means to be a victim and the suffering that goes with that. And we take our obligation to them very seriously. We don't want to use them. We want to give them what they need.
Is that what you were saying earlier about district attorneys over-promising victims and victims' families about what they were going to do in court?
Exactly. I mean, there's a very long tradition of politicizing victims. And that I have to tell you, honestly, I understand it more now that I'm in office than I did before, because there are consequences to being honest with people who are deeply grieving. Mm-hmm. And one of those consequences is that sometimes journalists who really only want to cover controversy instead of covering things that are happening systemically in a balanced way, sometimes they jump on that. You know, it does seem as we read the press that we are either angelic or devilish article to article, often in the same paper. And so I think that there was a little bit more method and a little less madness than I thought when it comes to the cynical way that prior prosecutors have dealt with victims. I think the truth is they had the reason, and the reason was never to be called out in the news by victims. You know, unfortunately,
you're blaming the press. You're blaming the press for bad coverage of what your office is doing.
I would say that we have some pretty excellent journalists in Philadelphia, obviously some excellent journalists nationally, but I do think that there is a very long history in criminal justice that has made policy worse of trying to cover everything in black and white, by which I mean the figures involved are either devils or they're angels, and there's nothing in between. And that's just not the truth. Individual justice recognizes all of the nuances and all the specifics of every case.
Does that surprise you, the kind of coverage you've been getting then?
You know, we've gotten an extremely widely varied type of coverage. So I'm surprised at the level of coverage, to be honest with you. I didn't think we were going to end up in national publications, certainly not two or three or four of them over the course of a month. That was not expected. But I do think people are pretty fascinated with the idea, and frankly, I think the truth, that the reform of criminal justice is the civil rights issue of our time, that the impact of mass incarceration on the country is so sweeping and so devastating that it actually makes crime worse.
A tweet from Gigi. Are there cases on which your office will see capital punishment consistent with state law? If not, then why do you have a capital committee?
So the state law never requires anyone to seek capital punishment. State law makes it available, and it's very clear under the law that discretion is vested with district attorneys and chief prosecutors to make those decisions. We have a committee, very much like the prior administration, that considers on an individual basis cases where there is a possibility of seeking the death penalty.
Right.
My chief of homicide supports the death penalty. And there are other
people. You do not, though.
And I have expressed repeatedly that I personally have problems with it based upon my having served on a jury, on a death penalty jury, and also having defended these cases. I think that it is, in general, bad policy, but my decision as a public official is to have this committee to work through all of these factors, ultimately to make a decision, but to make that decision on an individual basis informed by my own knowledge of the subject. So while I, you know, if I could wave a wand, I would change policy on this issue. That's not my obligation as a public official. It's right to consider the specifics.
You have your prosecutors include the cost of any prison sentence. It costs something like $42,000 a year to imprison someone in Pennsylvania. Why is that important to include?
Well, and the truth is actually those numbers are often much worse. The cost of incarcerating a juvenile can be in excess of $200,000 a year. And in Pennsylvania, it's been on the order of $150,000. It's really important for one reason, and that is that we want our prosecutors to think carefully before they recommend a particular period of years. We all know that a serious case may merit a 25-year sentence. Mm-hmm. And if it does, at $42,000, that's going to be $1,050,000. And that's worth it to society. But we also know that there are cases where it's very questionable of whether the taxpayer should be burdened that way. For example, someone suffering addiction, mm-hmm, or a sex worker. Or someone who has mental health issues, who has engaged in retail theft for the fifth time. It's a real serious question of whether those people should be going to jail on a $13 theft and costing the taxpayer $40,000 when that jail will not give them any kind of the treatment that they need. So that's really the purpose of it. And frankly, it has been a policy that unexpectedly has drawn tremendous national attention, quite a bit of national support from people who are finally willing to say we do have to look at the costs and the benefits of our policies.
We have an email from Joan. Krasner brings a sense of fairness to the process for all. Our son and his friend were arrested by Temple campus police unfairly. Philadelphia cops arrived and he was booked. Our lawyer told us the DA before Krasner had a policy of never dropping charges because it looked bad for their numbers. $50,000 in lawyer's fees and several hearings later, our son got 1 year probation for something he didn't do. But obviously, someone that feels like you're bringing some fairness to the system.
I'm not sure which case that is, but I guess thanks.
Well, but do you feel yourself sort of caught between perhaps the more progressive, even more progressive than you, supporters that you have, and also law enforcement in the city?
I wouldn't say that. You know, I feel like it's really important to do individual justice. I feel like it's really important not to believe that you're in any camp. I mean, even if we look at law enforcement, it's very easy, even for the left, to resort to stereotypes and imagine all police officers in Philadelphia as being older white men with short haircuts. But that's just not true. I mean, the truth is, when you look at the active police officers in Philly, you have a large portion of people of color. You have a lot of young officers who have a very different attitude in many instances about things like addiction and sex work than may have been the attitude previously. I mean, in my view, most of the active Philadelphia police officers I know, the vast majority are good people. They're problem solvers. They're decent. They're hardworking. They want society to be better. And they want to go home safe. And I respect every bit of that. So I don't feel in any way trapped in between those people. I mean, sure, I recognize that the head of the police union is going to say crazy. That's what he likes to do. But, you know, I mean, that's also just part of his public persona. So he's going to do that. I don't feel trapped. I actually feel like we're in a very good spot.
And that's Larry Krasner. He's Philadelphia's district attorney. And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. And we're going to have another district attorney join us after that break, Mark Gonzalez from Texas. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I've been talking with Larry Krasner. He is Philadelphia's district attorney about what has been called progressive prosecution, his approach to what he calls rebalancing the criminal justice system, whether ending mass incarceration, eliminating cash bail, addressing things like police misconduct. And joining us now is Mark Gonzalez. He was elected DA of Nueces County in Texas in 2016. He too took an unusual route to being district attorney, having been a defense attorney first. And like Larry Krasner, Gonzalez has been instituting a progressive criminal justice agenda, especially for low-level offenders with diversion programs and things like less severe sentences. And Mark Gonzalez, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me all the way over here from Texas, South Texas. So thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You have tattooed on your chest, not guilty. How come?
Well, I mean, honestly, it was good for business, to be honest with you, back when I was a defense attorney. And I really felt that in my heart that, you know, everyone is not guilty until the state meets its burden. And I still feel like that as the highest, obviously, law enforcement official in my county. Everybody is not guilty until we can prove our case. And that's what every prosecutor should actually feel and think and really consider when they're doing their job.
You've been on the job for about 2.5 years now. What has been the biggest surprise, I guess, from going from defense attorney to top prosecutor?
You know, the most surprising thing that I've actually, I guess, had to deal with is speaking to victims. When I was a defense attorney, it was me and my client versus everybody, you know, the government and everyone involved. But as a prosecutor, as a district attorney, speaking to victims and how it impacts them is probably the hardest part of the job. And I know when I'm going to have to speak to those individuals, I know it's going to be a long, long day. So that's one of the things that I never really considered as a defense attorney. And the other thing that I'll point out is capital punishment cases. You know, the first week I took office, there was a homicide here in my county. The first call I got is, hey, boss, what are we going to do? Are we seeking the death penalty? And when I had that question posed to me, it was crazy that me, one individual, is in charge of actually deciding what we are going to do.
And what did you do?
I believe on that one, we did not seek the death penalty. And I could tell you that my, I guess my view towards the death penalty evolves almost daily, and not daily, but, you know, over time. I have some in my administration that feel that the death penalty should never be imposed, that the government should never have a right. And then I have some on the opposite side. And so I want to say that I can't say that I'm for it or against it, but my view on it is that some cases, when they present the most horrendous facts, and that person doesn't have either some kind of mental issue or some shortcoming that he couldn't be held maybe like other individuals, that the community gets to decide. And so I'm for the jury actually making those decisions once in a while, not all the time,
right,
but in very horrendous cases. And if they cut the guy loose, say he's not guilty, that's great. If they put him you know, away for a very long time, that's also great. And sometimes, obviously, the ultimate consequence, which has not been, which actually hasn't occurred in my county. But we do have a case that's coming up, like I want to say, in the beginning of the year where that question will be posed. And I'm going to have to argue, you know, it's their decision. And it's crazy because the bishops in Texas came to my office and they said, you know, on behalf of the Texas bishops, we would ask that you not go forward on the death penalty. And I made a promise to them. I said, you know, Bishop, thank you for taking the time to come see me. I will tell your sentiments to the jury, and they can take that back there and decide with them, knowing the way at least the Texas bishops feel. And if anybody else comes to me and tells me their arguments, I'll convey those as well.
Let me get Larry Krasner in on the conversation. I know you two know each other. I think do some trash talking about football, as I understand it.
I just want to say the Cowboys won last Sunday. You know,
oh, dear. Here we go.
I'm going to say there. That's all I'm going to say.
That must be a good and unusual feeling. How are you, Mark? How are you doing?
How you doing, Larry? Good morning.
Good.
Let me ask you both, I don't know how much of a trend it is. You've been called progressive prosecutors, people that have come out of being defense attorneys and becoming prosecutors. Do you, Larry Krasner, do you see yourself as part of something that's changing in this country?
Yes, and when I say, you know, I'm not really speaking for me so much as this administration, this office of 600 people. Yes, I think we are part of something very important. I think Mark is part of something very important, which is actually one of the reasons why before I was in office, I visited him in Corpus Christi, sitting there in front of his beautiful painting of Zapata.
I read about that.
Yeah, which is, in fact, a beautiful painting. I visited him, and he and I have seen each other several times at gatherings of progressive prosecutors around the country.
What do you want to change? I mean, Mark, if you see yourself as part of this movement, what do you want to change?
Well, I know that I've come into office a little bit before Larry, but once he came in, man, he hit the road running. And I don't know if anybody in the nation is actually catching him, but he definitely is making a model for other cities his size, and even in mine. Mine's a smaller a city, a smaller county, but it still you know, pivots on the same values. We want to make sure that everyone has a fair and equal opportunity, and that we don't make a huge imprint on them for the future, so that way their lives aren't ruined. I think like right now is a great time for a movement of like-minded individuals to say, you know what, it's time for us to do the smart thing, but also just the right thing. You know, people don't belong in jail, shouldn't be there. People who go to jail end up getting victimized, costing, you know, either the county money in lawsuits. When they have medical issues, the county has to take care of those people who don't belong in jail. We use the jail system sometimes where we lack mental health care. At least in our county, you know, we don't have that, what we need. So it's very, you know, there's so many problems that we have an opportunity to fix. And if we don't do it now, it's just going to get worse.
I'm looking at a headline actually from the Huffington Post, but it has to do with the passage of what's called the First Step Act, bipartisan bill reducing some criminal sentences and advances in the Senate would be a major victory for criminal justice reform advocates. Larry Krasner, is this even beyond progressive prosecutors? Is there something that's changing in the country?
Yeah, I think that people like Mark and me are sick of watching all of our national resources go to things that don't work. There's an awful lot of 7-year-olds who could really use a second teacher in that classroom. They don't need 35 kids in that class. There's an awful lot of public school buildings in Philadelphia with a for sale sign on them. That is a disgrace. It is an absolute disgrace in a city where you have only half the people graduating high school. I mean, we all just got to stop being so stupid and spending all of our resources in ways that make no sense to advance the career of the careers of politicians. You know, we got to do better. This should be a much more direct democracy than it is. This should feel like and be like a movement of people who have been left out of the system. I think Mark's election is an indication of the reality that there are a lot of people who are very excited about getting into politics and supporting candidates, but only when it's people like Mark who run, or it's people who have been viewed, I think, wrongly as outsiders.
Mark, before we say goodbye to you, I'm just curious about what, in the almost 3 years or 2.5 years that you've been DA of Nueces County in Texas, what have you been able to change?
Well, for one thing, we decriminalize, I guess, or possession of marijuana, but more so than that, not just marijuana, low level offenses, right? Because there are 7 that Texas allows for officers not to arrest. And so hopefully February the 18th, our cite in lieu of arrest, as the sheriff likes to call it, we call it cite and release, but the sheriff wants to call it cite in lieu of arrest, we can call it whatever he wants. But all I know is those people won't be going to jail. There's 7 offenses, and they won't be going to jail, not putting a burden on the taxpayers for us housing them there, $81 a day. Most people stay 2 to 3 nights. So we'll be saving our county at least, you know, $50,000 to $75,000 a month just on those 305 arrests that we get every month. So I'm glad that those people won't be going to jail. They won't be victimized in jail, and the taxpayer's not going to have that burden. So that's one of the things that we're looking forward to, and it all started out with just probably decriminalizing the first step of individuals who possess marijuana. So there are many things I would love to do, such as ending the cash bail system. We've gone to a lot of PR bonds for personal recognizance bonds for the low-level offenses. And, you know, those are just – we're trying to change the outlook and make sure we're not – people who make mistakes, you know, they learn from them. And people who really need to go away, well, obviously we're doing that too. So, you know, those are the things that we're trying to accomplish. And we're looking forward and taking cues from all the progressive district attorneys across the nation. And Larry's obviously one of them who we look for to what we can do down here to make sure that, you know, we're doing what's appropriate.
Mark Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Can I ask Mark a question?
Yeah, you can. Go ahead.
Mark, I've been thinking about it. I'm just wondering about your thoughts if I should get a tattoo that says guilty.
Don't do it, Larry. Don't do it. Oh, man. No.
Mark Gonzalez.
Go Cowboys, by the way.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear is right.
Mark Gonzalez, he was elected DA of Nueces County in Texas in 2016. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Actually, something you said to me, Larry, is that Mark, who was a defense attorney like yourself, now prosecutes cases in court, something you have been thinking about doing?
Well, you know, the reality is that Mark and I were not real politicians. We were real trial lawyers. You know, he's quite a bit younger than me, but we both tried a ton of cases. I love trying cases. I always love
trying. Do you miss the courtroom?
I do miss the courtroom. And I've been there a few times, you know, either standing up to handle a particular issue, a particular hearing with a judge, or sometimes to confer. But I haven't had a chance to do what I used to do all the time, which is go to court and actually try cases. I do think that there is a role for either picking cases that have some level of significance to the public and could restore faith in the system itself, or possibly the flip side, which is just doing completely ordinary cases, including losing cases, including, you know, very difficult, mundane, ordinary cases, just so that the troops, by which I mean these almost 300 attorneys, know that the person who's sitting in the chair is willing to do the same stuff they're willing to do. So I'm hoping to try some cases next year.
Maybe someone had a question about your office, about Mumia Abu-Jamal, something I asked you actually before we went on the air here. Is your office involved in his case at all?
We are. The reason we are involved is that the United States Supreme Court made a decision having to do with what is the proper role of an appellate judge who used to be the prosecutor. And obviously, many people know that Ron Castile was on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Long before that, he was the district attorney of Philadelphia County. So the Mumia Abu-Jamal case, which is a homicide case involving the killing of a police officer, came through the office when he was the prosecutor, and then much later he sat on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and made some decisions about that case. The issue that the Supreme Court has is essentially this. How involved was he, right? And there were motions that were made and that were pending when we came into office that have to be addressed. They were not made by us. They were made by defense attorneys. We had to go through an exhaustive process of looking through boxes, and not only boxes in the Mumia Abu-Jamal case, but other boxes, to see to what extent the Williams standards were met. To what extent did Ron Castile himself make important decisions in the Mumia Abu-Jamal case. To date, we have reported to the court multiple times on our searches. To date, our position has been and remains that we do not see evidence of significant involvement by then-DA Castile that would disqualify him from those decisions.
Oh, interesting. What is your relationship with the police department or even the police commissioner, Ross? I ask that because as a defense attorney or civil rights attorney, you prosecuted something like 75 cases involving police officers. What is your relationship today?
Thank you for saying prosecuted, by the way.
Oh, excuse me. Yes.
Because the truth is, in that era, there was no prosecution and no holding accountable.
I guess I should say cases involving police misconduct or alleged misconduct.
You might say that I and a hearty band of people who did some litigation around police killings and police violence and police corruption, we were the only prosecutors for that activity at that time. But anyway, I'm off on the side rail. Let me get back on the
That's
rail.
Okay.
So, I mean, Commissioner Ross and I have an excellent relationship. We have enjoyed an excellent relationship since before I came into office. I've found him to be very, very supportive of a lot of what we're trying to do, and we've tried to support him in various ways. For example, both he and the mayor came to me and asked me to do what I could to cut overtime for police officers so that we could have more of them on the street patrolling, especially in areas where there's a lot of shootings. And I was happy to do that. I mean, but for their asking me, it wouldn't have been our top priority, but we made it a top priority because he asked me to do that. For example, there have been a number of instances in which the police commissioner has determined that there was serious misconduct by a police officer, and he's fired officers only to have us come around, at least in one case that I can think of right now, and bring criminal charges. We are, in certain instances, independently validating each other. He is no longer walking a plank all by himself being screamed at.
This would be Ross.
Right. He's no longer walking a plank being screamed at by the leadership of the Fraternal Order of Police when the district attorney comes around having done a thorough criminal investigation and says, yeah, it's actually not just a disciplinary issue. This is a crime. So I think in many ways we have been totally independent and have totally independent judgment, but we have been mutually supportive because we want the same thing. We want the good police officers to be elevated and to be able to do their job, which is not sitting in court hallways unnecessarily. It is to be on the street solving problems in society.
We're almost out of time, and I apologize for asking this question, but should ICE be abolished?
Well, you know, that is a long topic. I'll give you a short answer. Short answer is, in many ways, yes.
Because
it has become something that INS, the Immigration and Nationalization Service, did not used to be. And because, frankly, a lot of us are sick of hearing about seven-year-olds dying and watching numbers be drawn onto the arms of human beings.
Larry Krasner, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's always great to be here. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Again, District Attorney Larry Krasner, our guest. We also called out to another district attorney of the similar stripe, and by that I mean being a defense attorney before becoming a top prosecutor, Mark Gonzalez from Texas. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and you can actually sign up for our Facebook group as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.